And welcome to week three of When Science and Torah Clash. There are sheets on the table. If you're not getting these sheets by email, please let me know, because I do believe I have everyone on the email list for the class. I heard from somebody this morning that they didn't get the email notice in advance about the series, and therefore they're missing it and they feel bad. So you should just know in general, you know, if you signed up and were at a class, I will continue to send you notices of upcoming classes. In the event that you're not seeing notices of upcoming classes, that means that your spam blocker is eating it. It doesn't mean I've stopped sending it to you. I only stop sending in the event that you ask not to receive. But other than that, they're going to keep on coming. So if there's radio silence for a while, that means that that your spam blocker is preventing the emails from getting through. Okay, so we are on the topic of Copernicus and the Jews. This is our second topic leading into the third week, though. We spent our first week setting out the problem of science and Torah and what the options are when there's an apparent clash between observed reality or the conclusions of the scientific method and what the Torah teaches, what the rabbis have explained about Torah. And then we moved into this example of the case, well, we talked about the example of the cow that wouldn't die and the question of the laws of Trefot and how sometimes Jewish law doesn't seem concerned with observed reality. Observed reality does not actually affect and change what the law states. Then we started on Copernicus, and we said that in the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century, Copernicus suggests a way to solve problems with the observed orbits of the planets. Because the old model, dating back to Ptolemy, was a model which said that everything went around the Earth. And problems with retrograde motion, which we discussed a little bit last week, problems in terms of the planets not showing up where we would have expected them to show up, had bothered observers for centuries, if not millennia, and they had come up with ways to solve the problems, but the solutions became less elegant as you played them out, and they still didn't quite fit reality. So they came up with the idea of epicycles, the idea that the planets are orbiting around the Earth, but they're also orbiting around another point. You came up with, it was kind of like a lab. If you remember high school lab, right, where you knew there were certain results you were supposed to end up with, but your experiments didn't actually get there. So, you know, you came up with different ways to make it all work. And that's what it started to look like. And Copernicus said, actually, this can work better if we just have everything going around the sun instead of going around the Earth. And his approach wasn't perfect. There were problems still with his approach, as we noted last week, but it did a better job, fundamentally, of accounting for what was observed. Now, we said already last week, the general world did not accept Copernicus's theory at first. Forget the Jewish world. The general world didn't accept it. He was another scientist presenting an argument. You know, until Galileo comes along, and Galileo's observations fit what Copernicus has predicted, that gives it strength, and then the spread and the debate over the course of the 17th century until the early 18th century, when it really gains widespread acceptance. So we talked a little bit about why this was problematic for Jews. And we presented verses from Tanakh, from our prophets, which presented the problem. We had, for example, the verse in Joshua that talked about the sun standing still. And it makes it look like the sun's been moving and suddenly Joshua stops it, even though Copernicus is saying that the sun is standing still. Right? Mind you that in the 20th century, with the idea that everything is relative to everything else, nothing is standing still. The sun isn't standing still either. But in Copernicus's model, the sun is fixed. So how do you stop the sun? It doesn't make any sense. And then a similar passage in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, where the sunset is delayed, verses like Ecclesiastes, where it says that the earth stands forever, don't seem to be true if you're saying the earth is moving around the sun, and that creates a problem. But the last bit that we did last time, and I didn't bring the sources again on the sheet because we talked about it somewhat last time, is the issue of anthropocentrism. The idea that human beings are at the center teleologically in terms of the purpose of the universe. We are at the center, and therefore we must also be at the center geographically. if we are the purpose of everything, then everything should revolve around us. Physically, everything should revolve around us. And we noted that the Rambam disagreed with the whole concept. Maimonides said, we aren't the most important thing in the universe. Get over it. But that notwithstanding, most sages over the ages disagreed with him and said, no, we actually are. Not because we are so wonderful, but because of the potential that human beings have. Because we have free choice. Because we, unlike inanimate objects, unlike animals, are given the opportunity to grow past instinct, and we have the possibility of doing things like delaying gratification and making decisions based on greater values and even denying things to ourselves for the sake of the community, which have been taken historically as demonstrations of that which makes us human as opposed to the other species. Leave aside the question of whether that's really true. In other words, do other species have any level of free will or not? That's something worth discussing another time. But that was certainly the assumption, that that's what makes us special and is great enough that we are the purpose of everything. God creates the physical realm in order that there should be beings who have freedom of choice and who learn to use it properly. And if so, everything should revolve around us. However, one might logically ask, and indeed I was asked in an email after the class last week, who cares about the sun going around the earth? Why is physical orientation all that meaningful? Granted that, it was an assumption that people had made, and it fit biblical verses. Is that really something that you have to get so hung up on that, you know, for someone to say, no, actually the sun doesn't go around the earth, that's going to challenge your view of the purpose of the universe? Why was this really such a big deal? What would you say?
There were a lot of opinions. There was always controversy. So maybe that's why.
Well, I would say just the opposite. Marilyn says there was always controversy. I would argue if there was always controversy about this, then you should be more open to the idea that, okay, I might be wrong, someone else might be right. It doesn't shake everything I've ever believed in. I think one of the reasons why this is such a shock to the system is because in lockstep, everyone who disagreed about everything else understood we are the center. We're the center in terms of the purpose of the universe, and we are the center in terms of the physical universe. And this was like somebody coming out of left field and saying, oh, actually, that's not true. You know, today, I hope, all of us around the table can agree that there's such a thing as gravity. Right? I think we're good with that? If someone were to come along and say, actually, no, there isn't such a thing as gravity, we would look at them and say, no, that's bizarre. You can't suggest such a thing. Or, to take it in terms of religion, right? I hope we can all basically agree there's a prohibition against murder found in the Torah. And again, I'm just going to take it as a given. I don't need a show of hands. That you're not supposed to murder. What if somebody were to come along and say to you that, no, murder actually is okay within the Torah? Yeah, you'd laugh them out of the room. You'd say that's nonsense. To them, the placement of the earth in the center was so agreed upon by everybody that it wasn't even subject to debate and had become anchored in this religious concept that we are at the center in terms of purpose. And I think that's part of it. It's just so entrenched. But I think it's actually more than that. There's another reason besides the fact that it's so entrenched. And by the way, it wasn't just us. Again, as we said last time, Christian Europe thought this also. It wasn't, you know, just us. The Muslims thought it too. But I think more than that, you have to remember what science looked like until the Enlightenment. Science in the Middle Ages blends physics and metaphysics. The two go together. Science and philosophy go together. Example, astronomy and astrology were not separate concepts until the modern age. The idea that there are planets out there and stars out there and they have their paths and their roles and whatever was blended inextricably with the idea that they also are conscious. There are beings out there. And they have some kind of say over what's happening here on Earth. And granted that not all of our sages believed in astrology. There was debate on that score, and in the greater world, not just in the Jewish world. The concept of it, they were fundamentally linked. They were blended together. Another example. How much does a soul weigh? A human soul. S-O-U-L. How much does a neshama weigh? Sorry, someone said it. 21 grams. That's right, 21 grams. That was the classic idea that a soul actually has weight to it. There's mass and weight to a neshama, such that if you weighed somebody just before they passed away, and then you weighed them afterwards, there will be a difference of 21 grams. There was a doctor, yeah. I mean, it's ludicrous from our perspective, but that was absolutely believed. There was a doctor in New Jersey, because it was either going to be New Jersey or Florida, but there was a doctor in New Jersey in the early 20th century who actually tried experiments with this. And then there were all sorts of reasons why this experiment wasn't good, that experiment wasn't good. He can never pin it down in terms of how much weight people lost when they passed away. But it's an interesting diet. That's for sure. But the idea that the soul had mass and weight was part of this blending of the philosophical metaphysical with the physical world around us. That doesn't stop with Copernicus, by the way, but that's part of why there's this belief that the physical universe has to reflect philosophical ideas. If we believe that we are in the middle in terms of the purpose of the universe, then we must be in the middle in terms of the physical universe. Sir Isaac Newton was a heavy, heavy mystic. People don't realize this. Like the hard-headed, you know, we think of him in terms of, well, hard-headed in terms of the apple, fine, and the story about apple and gravity. But a mathematician, par excellence, actually considered himself much more of a mystic and, believe it or not, Kabbalist. You know, in school, when they taught us the colors of the rainbow, they gave us that acronym Roy G. Biv, right? What was the I?
Indigo.
What's the difference between indigo and the colors around it? Right, it's blue, indigo, violet. Can you really distinguish in a rainbow between indigo and blue and violet? Depends on your eye, perhaps. You might have a trained eye for it. Most people, though, look at it and see blue and purple. Well, how do you end up with indigo and violet? The answer is, as I understand it, I haven't traced it in Newton's writings, but this is what is said about it, is that Newton believed in the value of the number 7. And 7 as a special number, and therefore he wanted 7 colors in the rainbow. And so therefore purple becomes indigo and violet in order to reach 7. This is not... Newton was... I don't know what to tell you except to look at source number 1. This may be the best example of it. 1942, John Maynard Keynes is invited to give a lecture on Newton the man. It was the anniversary of one of the anniversaries of Newton's death. And actually, Keynes died before he could give the lecture. He wrote the lecture, and then somebody else, I think his brother, delivered it. But he studied Newton's personal papers. And this is the conclusion that he came to, part of the lecture, in source number 1. He says, in the 18th century and since, Newton came to be thought of as the first and greatest of the modern age of scientists, a rationalist, one who taught us to think on the lines of cold and untinctured reason. I do not see him in this light. I do not think that anyone who has pored over the contents of that box which he packed up when he finally left Cambridge in 1696, and which, though partly dispersed, have come down to us... Those are the papers that he had studied. Anyone who pored over those contents, I don't think they can see him like that. Newton was not the first of the age of reason. He was the last of the magicians, the last of the Babylonians and Sumerians, the last great mind which looked out on the visible and intellectual world with the same eyes as those who began to build our intellectual inheritance rather less than 10,000 years ago. The last of the magicians. A serious believer in the occult, somebody who valued that kind of study more, in fact, than his scientific work. Why? It was this blend of the philosophical and the physical. And so to come to the Jews and say, or to the Christians for that matter, and say, even though you may believe that you are the purpose of the universe, the world doesn't revolve physically around you, It was a bizarre idea and one that they were not willing to accept. And so early reactions in the Jewish world were fairly negative. We had been teaching the Ptolemaic model, the model of Ptolemy, for ages. As a matter of fact, the Talmud, I didn't bring it on here because it's a rather involved source. But the Talmud in a volume called Psachim, it's Tzadi Daled Amud Beis 94b, actually has a debate between the Jewish scholars and the non-Jewish scholars about the way that the stars are placed and how they function. And the sages of the Talmud say, we gave in. We accepted the model that the scientists taught us. Maimonides, in his work of law, Mishneh Torah, brings the Ptolemaic model for how the planets are arranged. Generally speaking, our view was the model set down by Ptolemy ages ago works for us. There is an interesting source which is sometimes brought to suggest that there was an early Jewish sage who adopted the view of Copernicus. You've heard of him. His name was the Maharal of Prague, right? Usually credited with making a golem, although widely understood not to have made a golem. It would have been a waste of his time. But take a look at source number two. This is what he writes regarding the difference between science and the traditions of Judaism. He says, he doesn't refer to Copernicus by name, but this is clearly the person who he is referring to, who would have been contemporary with him. He says, just as one came along who was called the master of a new science, and he presented a model contradicting all that the early ones gave as a model describing the path of the stars and constellations and celestial causes. He gave a model from a new wisdom, and he himself wrote that he still could not resolve all of the issues. Right? So he says, along came Copernicus, and he gave a brand new model that seems to resolve a lot of problems, but it changes what had been taught before, and he couldn't solve all the problems either. And when Israel calculates cycles and constellations and gives good logic and knowledge, it is because that which secular scholars debate regarding the time in which the sun circles its sphere and the moon its sphere, they don't agree with each other. How could they agree? Each one is clever via his own knowledge and intellect. So what he's doing is presenting a contrast. He says, the way they do it, they all debate and they can't come up with answers. When we do it, we have a tradition, and therefore our tradition is right and accepted and everybody's good with it. That's the statement that the Maharal makes. He's not really supporting Copernicus, but it's been quoted as, see, he studied it and he liked it. There was a writer by the name of Andre Neher, who I'm going to quote actually in number four, who claimed that Maharal was positive to Copernicus, but it doesn't seem to be correct. The first one we find in Jewish writers who likes what Copernicus has to say is going to be Rabbi David Gans. Source number three. Student of the Maharal of Prague. Take a look at what he says in source number three. This was originally published as a pamphlet. It became part of a larger book called Nechmad Vinaim on science in general. And he says, Nicholas Copernicus of Prussia was a great sage, extraordinary in knowledge of astronomy beyond any of his contemporary sages. The sages of our own age, too, unanimously testify to his sharp intellect and deep comprehension of this field of knowledge. They say of him that since the days of Ptolemy, the likes of him has not been seen. And with his extraordinarily sharp intellect, his heart moved him to show that the earth revolves in a perpetual circular orbit. This is not new. The ancient Greeks, too, had such an idea 2,000 years ago. And you, the reader, based on all that was said above, you will think that the essence... Well, actually, I'm going to hold off on that line. I have to come back to that line. I'm not quite ready for that one. But the message that he gives is that Copernicus is a brilliant sage. His work, this pamphlet that became a book, was published with serious letters of approval by great sages of his time. But interestingly, he doesn't adopt the Copernican model either. He ends up with the model of Tycho Brahe. Tycho Brahe being a later astronomer, who actually Gans knew personally, and he proposed a model which retained the Earth being at the center. And for a while, it was a popular model as a way to not accept Copernicus, effectively. So even this one, who is a fan of Copernicus in general, does not actually adopt his view. I do have to show you, though, this other sentence that he has in that same section, which I brought you at the end of number three. He says, and you, the reader, based on all that was said above, meaning all his praise of Copernicus, he says, you will think that the essence of astronomy came to us from the nations. But you should know that it is not so. The essential knowledge of this field came first from our nation, and they got it from us. And what he's proposing is a very old idea, It's not unique to Jews. Everyone, you know, tends to think this. But the idea that, in fact, we were the originators of various sciences, and the world got their ideas from us. That's where they developed their brilliance. It came from our sages. Now, we have an awful lot to be very proud of in our history. And there are many things that the world did get from us. And you can trace it through the documents of history. At the same time, this one is a hard sell. This one is a difficult sell. But it is a popular idea. So what we have is the Maharal of Prague saying, scientists all fight with each other. And Copernicus is an example of that, how they all come along and they suggest things, and then others come along and they suggest other things, whereas we have our ideas and that's it. You have Rabbi Gans, who accepts that Copernicus is great, although he doesn't accept his particular conclusion on this model. And then the great majority of rabbis who wrote about this issue through the 18th century said absolutely not. No, it's just wrong. The earth is, in fact, at the middle. If you take a look at source number 4, this is the André Neher who I mentioned earlier. It's a great article. You can find it online. Copernicus in the Hebraic Literature. And unlike most of the material that you have here, it actually is in English. Meaning, I think that the... Keynes also was in English. But the other sources that you have here tend to be ones that I translated. But this one you could find online, and it's an interesting read. His agenda in this article in the Journal of the History of Ideas, his agenda is to say that Jews actually were early adopters of the Copernican model. He wants to suggest that actually we were good with it. So when he deals with those who opposed it, he says the following. For the Jews, the problem was not that of a contradiction between science and Bible, but between science and the traditional Jewish reading of the Bible which the Talmud gave. When he says Talmud, he means rabbis. It isn't Talmud per se. But in other words, what he's saying is what we already noticed last week. You can explain all the verses. It isn't as though Joshua stopping the sun is proof that Torah must believe that the world is in the middle and everything, that the earth is in the middle and everything goes around it. You could explain all the verses, but it's the way that tradition has explained those verses that creates a problem. The verses of the Bible which the authority of the Christian churches cited in opposition to the Copernicans, the miracle of Joshua stopping the sun, a verse in Psalms, or many other passages. How easy it was to bring such verses into harmony with Copernicus after the impressive flowering of Jewish exegesis in the Middle Ages had proposed interpretations of many such passages. And he quotes a verse, the sparks leaving from the rock on being struck by a hammer. That verse is understood to refer to the way that Torah is understood in many different ways, like the sparks from a hammer blow. The sun had not been stopped at Givon. It had been silenced into a momentary stillness of the heavenly spheres, admirably confirmed by the musical theory harmony of the spheres constructed by Kepler on Copernicus' theory. So he says, we're really okay. Judaism is able to accept those ideas, like the idea of Copernicus, that science develops. Nonetheless, generally speaking, as I said, the sages did not, the sages of those times. Whether because of anthropocentrism, whether because they viewed it as part of the vanguard of science and taking away from tradition, they didn't accept it. And I wanted to just show you a few quotes. One in particular is very important, number 5. This comes from a work by Tuvia Cohn, also known as Tuvia HaRofe. A Rofe is a doctor. Correct, Dr. Tuvia. So he wrote a work called Maasei Tuvia, in which he writes the following. This is published in 1707. Every godly philosopher should oppose the view of Copernicus and his allies. All of the proofs brought by him and his allies are against the sacred scriptures and the words of the prophets of truth, who are honest in their words. Know how to respond to him, for he is Bechor Satan. Now, when I first saw this quoted, because I'm not that familiar with the works of Tuvia HaRofe, I have to admit, I saw an article in which he had been cited. I looked at that and thought, that's interesting. Bechor Satan, as it was quoted in this article, was like a headline phrase. Right? Bechor Satan means, you don't need me to tell you. What does it mean? Firstborn of Satan. Tell me something. Does that sound like a Jewish term? That sounds like something we would have lifted, right, from the church. Satan exists within Tanakh, But generally speaking, it has its original meaning and its original etymology from a verb meaning to obstruct. If you remember the story of Bilam, who goes to curse the Jews, and then an angel stands in his way, the angel is described as being there l'satan lo. Doesn't mean it's Satan standing in front of him. It means the angel's there to obstruct him, to block his path. And that's usually the way it is intended. There are a couple of descriptions in Tanakh of an entity called a Satan. But the idea of a Bechor Satan doesn't sound like one of ours. And the truth of the matter is that they do use this quote as a headline quote. Like, look at that. The rabbi called Copernicus the firstborn of Satan. The problem is that, and this is why I gave you the reference in bold in source number 5, they don't know the origin of the phrase Bechor Satan. The origin of the phrase is actually in a Talmudic debate in which one of the sages disagrees with another one, bless you, and he says, be careful of this one, he is Bechor Satan. Now, one sage in the Talmud is not calling another sage the firstborn of Satan. As Rashi there, the classic commentator, explains on that line in the Talmud, what he's doing is he's using the word Satan in its original biblical sense, which means he's somebody who gives people a hard time. He tries to obstruct people. Bechor Satan means he is an obstructionist. He likes to argue with people. He's argumentative. That's what the phrase means. So when you see a source headlined as Rabbi calls Copernicus firstborn of Satan, no, Rabbi calls Copernicus argumentative and quarrelsome. Because he was. He didn't agree with what anybody else in the world had to say. He's not calling him the firstborn of Satan, for goodness sake. But that's the way the line gets taken. Nonetheless, it is true that the rabbis objected to what he had to say. In source number 6, Rabbi David Nieto wrote a work called Kuzari Sheni. What was the original Kuzari intended to do? The book Kuzari? What was the goal of the Kuzari? Right. Well, it's the original book Kuzari is published to defend Judaism against the ideas of others, whether Christians, whether agnostics, whatever it was, general philosophy. The original work was published in order to defend Judaism. What happens in the book itself, the narrative of the book, is that there was a nation called the Khazars, not to be confused with Khazir, spelled differently, entirely different, but the Khazars, who live somewhere in Turkey, and their king has a dream. In this dream, he is visited by God, an angel, whatever it is, to tell him, you know, your intentions are good, but your deeds are not good. You're righteous king. You're trying to do right, but what you're doing is bad. And the king tries different religions, and he wants to worship, and he finds that he's being rejected. And so he summons a Christian, a Muslim, a general philosopher, and he wants them all to explain to him what he should be doing. Not a Jew originally. All three of those. And he says, tell me about your religions, tell me what you believe, tell me what I should be doing. And he doesn't like, bless you, he doesn't like what any of them are saying. Each of them he has a reason to reject. And then he's presented with the Jew. He says, I didn't want to talk to the Jew because they're a tiny nation, they're downtrodden, and clearly there's no significance to them. But all right, fine, I'll ask the Jew also. And he's enamored of what the Jew has to say, and then the rest of the book, that's the very beginning of the book, the rest of the book is dialogue between this king and the Jew, and gradually the king converts, and he converts his nation, and there's a lot of historical debate as to whether this was true, or whether this is a made-up story. Was this entirely just the fantasy of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writing this in the 11th century, or is there a kernel of truth to it? There actually does, historically, I think the pendulum has swung towards believing there actually was a nation like this, and there was a conversion to Judaism, but no, the narrative that's in the book is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi reconstructing what the debate could have been like. It isn't that this is actually what went on. But in terms of the role of the Kuzari, the subtitle of the book, it's called the Kuzari, because the Kuzari is the name of the king, but the subtitle of the book is In Defense of the Despised Faith. Because one of the arguments that the Christians used against Jews in that period of time, the Muslims also, but the Christians are more known for it, was the fact that you are such a small nation and nobody cares about what you have to say demonstrates that God is not on your side. We are strong. We are the ones who the world has accepted. Our beliefs are the ones you should be adopting. So this book is intended to defend Judaism against it. Well, Rabbi David Nieto, in, as you see, 17th to 18th century England, he was in London, decides the time has come to update the Kuzari from the original in the 11th century. And so he writes something that becomes known as Kuzari Sheni, the second Kuzari. And he addresses this issue of Copernican thought, and he says the holders of this Copernican belief have struggled to answer this challenge, meaning the challenge of Joshua holding the sun, but they have strained for naught. Their answer is inadequate. And so in his Kuzari, he actually rejects the ideas of Copernicus. If you flip the page, Rabbi Yehonatan Eibeschitz, no stranger to controversy in his own right, he says, many of the astronomers, Copernicus and his entourage, have been foolish, saying that the earth revolves. They have inherited falsehood. The truth testifies to itself that the earth stands eternally. And so on. The opposition continues all the way into the 19th century. Some rabbinic writers start to oppose Copernicus on scientific grounds. They quote the science and say, we think that we disagree with him because he's wrong on this particular point. And going back to our first source last week, we saw Rabbi Shlomo Ben Isri, who had been a member of the Knesset, right? That was the, I didn't reproduce it in this week's sheet, but a former member of Knesset, who said, I still don't believe in Copernicus. Our tradition says that everything revolves around the earth, and that's the way it is. Now, not everybody goes that route. Many, certainly most rabbis I am familiar with, accept the scientific discovery at this point, and they go with one of the approaches we already defined earlier, to say that when the verses indicate that the earth is the center, that's meant allegorically. It doesn't mean literally. It's based on the way that the observer would look at it. The sun seems to stop, right? I noted last week that even though I believe Copernicus was right, I still talk about the sun moving across the sky. Right? I say the sun was low in the sky. I say the sun rose, the sun set. Even though, per Copernicus, that makes no sense whatsoever. Yeah, but that's what it looks like, and that's the way we talk. And that's the way the Torah talked as well. The phrase in Hebrew, Dibra Torah Kelashon B'nei Adam. Right? The Torah speaks with the language of human beings. That tends to be the way that people deal with this. You know, a Jew who believes in Torah need not believe that the sun goes around the earth. The Trefa case was actually the harder case, because there was a matter of Jewish law. That made things more challenging. But yes, opposition remains. The opposition is not really about a scientific debate at this point. It's about the issue of challenging tradition. That's really what it's fundamentally about. And so I want to update our model for why representatives of Judaism and Torah might reject science. We already said that they might reject science because of fear of undermining divine authority by opting for human observation. We talked about the potential weakness of the scientific model in the sense that it doesn't rely on proof as much as on theory. We talked about Christian pressure. We talked about disappointment and the lack of moral advancement by the leaders of scientific revolutions. We added a factor that sometimes Torah doesn't care about scientific advances. Sometimes Jewish law is influenced by other issues, in the case of the Trefa. But now we need to add another element, which is tradition. Sometimes it's simply a matter of saying, this is what my rabbi believed, and his rabbi believed before him, and his rabbi believed before him, and I'm not willing to veer from the statements of my predecessors. Sometimes it's as simple as that. And that's the reason for not accepting what science says, and that's what creates a clash. You follow?
I agree.
Okay. Marilyn has given her stamp, so now we're good. Well, that brings me to what many people think of first, and I'm going to.